Science Friday is supported by Progressive. Now, most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato at the Brown Theater in Louisville, Kentucky. Tonight's theme is On the Rocks, and Kentucky has a proud geologic history. There's the limestone that helps make the caves. There's agate, the official state rock. And even though it's not actually a mineral, the official state mineral is coal. But we wanted to look at coal in a new way. And I want you to think of coal not as just a dirty black rock that burns, but as a time capsule. And joining us now to open that time capsule is Jen O'Keefe. She's a professor of geology and science education at Morehead State University. She's also a palynologist. I get that right?
You got that right,
An
Ira.
Expert on spores and pollen. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Now, you look at a piece of coal. What do you see there that we don't see? What is your interest in studying coal?
I'm really interested in why we have coal in the first place and what it can tell us about ancient environments. We're watching our environments change in crazy ways now, and we don't have great records on how they've changed in the past for most people. You know, little things from, I drive back and forth to Texas a lot, and it used to be you didn't see a dead armadillo until you got to the Texas border. Now we see them in western Kentucky. Why is that? We've got this great time capsule in our backyard that we can start to pick apart. And a lot of the picking it apart is on the microscopic level. And when I start looking, I see the intricate details hidden from view.
Can you actually slice the coal up?
We can.
Thin enough?
We can. We can slice it down to a third of a millimeter thick and make a thin section.
Wow.
And at that point, you can see right through it, and you can see the cellular structure of the plants and the fungi and sometimes other organisms that are making up the coal. You get really, really cool things.
Wow. That's beautiful green color. All
it is. This is a cannel coal from eastern Kentucky. This one is from near Cannel City. And you're looking at the glowing algae and spores from over 200 million years ago that make up this particular coal.
So we're really looking at fossils. The coal is a fossil.
Absolutely. The coal is a fossil. It's fossil plants. It's fossil algae. It's fossil fungi.
So tell us what the difference between spores and pollen. What's the difference when you look at them?
Okay, so spores are a form of usually unisexual reproduction. There's some interesting fossil plants that seem to have two kinds of spores. Pollen is part of bisexual plant reproduction. The pollen is the male reproductive gamete.
And of course, once you get these things, you can figure out what the environment was and when that coal was produced?
Right. So for a lot of the coals we look at, we see many, many, many pollen grains or many plant spores, depending on if we're before angiosperms, which produce pollen, evolved, or after. Here in Kentucky, most of our coals contain plant spores because they're produced long before. Where I work in the Gulf Coast and in China and in other countries, we see a lot of angiosperm pollen. But along with both of these, we see an awful lot of fungal spores.
Wow.
And that had us scratching our head going, could we help modern mycologists tie their evolutionary lineages directly to the fossil record? So we started working with a bunch of modern mycologists from Argentina, where they are training people still in the almost lost art of recognizing fungi
using
recognizing mushrooms just using the spores.
Can the fungi that you see tell us about anything about the animals that live during those times?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. We have been doing a lot of work up on samples from Big Bone Lick with Craft Academy students from Morehead State. This is our residential high school. And they're finding all kinds of fungal spores that only grow on dung. So the poop spores. The fun part about this is we have some fungi, like Ascobolus, that really, really, really like to grow on waterfowl poo. We have no bones of waterfowl from Big Bone Lick. We have bones of big things from Big Bone Lick. Now we know we had waterfowl, too.
See if I have a question. Do you have a question? Or? Yes, step up to the mic.
Is there any specific type of coal that works best for your research, or is it just any coal?
We look specifically for coal that's not very woody. If it's too woody, we don't see a lot of pollen and spores. We just see wood fragments.
Wow. Yes. Step up.
So when you're looking at a slice of coal and you see like a 200 million year old fungi spore, how are you how do you identify what type of fungi it is?
Well, sometimes they have specific ornamentation, so they have decoration on the outside of the fungus that's very distinctive. Sometimes we have to sit down and make very, very precise measurements and extract it from the coal and look at it by itself and roll it around and put it under an SCM and take detailed pictures. And there are some we can't identify because a lot of fungi, especially basidiomycetes, make simple spores that are really tough to tell apart.
Is the coal uniform around the world? I mean,
no, there are a lot of variations. So just here in Kentucky, we have three completely different kinds of coal. We have bituminous coal, which is what we tend to mine. We have a little bit of anthracite coal, mostly near igneous intrusions, so near rocks that produced garnets rather than diamonds out in western Kentucky and eastern Kentucky. And out in the Jackson Purchase, we have lignite, which is very, very low rank. You wouldn't want to burn the stuff at all, but it makes an amazing environmental record.
Do the miners or the extractors ever come to you and say, we got something? Or we can
yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Like what?
Very often they'll call me up and say, I have this strange axe handle in my coal. Can I bring it to you?
Let me say that again. You have a strange axe handle?
Axe handle in my coal. Can I bring it to you? I say, oh, sure, bring it down. And it's usually a fossil root and sometimes a fossil stem that's been compressed, and it looks just like an axe handle. It's pretty neat stuff.
We have a question from this young man here. Yes.
When you see the spores, how are you able to know how the plant would look like?
So that has taken a lot of work over time looking for the plants that the spores and pollen came from. We've had to go out and work very closely with modern botanists and paleobotanists and mycologists and paleomycologists to try and tie the pollen and spores we see to the organism. And sometimes we don't. We have no idea what some of these things looked like when they were alive.
So I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today. Jen O'Keefe, Professor of Geology and Science Education at Morehead State University. We're on the rocks tonight, and recently Science Friday took a deep dive into geology with our science club. I hope you're a member of our science club. And here's Charles Berquist, Science Friday's director. He's the guy behind all the controls in the control room and one of the founding members of the science club to talk about that. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Ira. It's good to be here.
Tell everybody who's not familiar with our science club what the science club is.
So the science club is our occasional invitation for people to go out, do science, and share it with others. You may be familiar with a book club where everybody goes and reads the same book and then talks about it. We challenge you to go and do something and then talk about it.
Give us an idea, for example.
So in the past, we've had people make a machine that makes art. We've said, go out and just figure out some way of making an art machine for us. A couple weeks ago, we had people try to make new forms of ice or make their ice better.
Make your ice better.
Make your ice better.
And also, we had a project recently that has to do with what we're talking about tonight, and this was really exciting, rocks. Tell us about the rocks project.
So in the beginning of October, we said, you know, everybody's got that neat rock. You're out for a hike, you're at the lake, and you go, oh, wow, That's so cool. I'm going to take this home with me. I don't know what it is. I'm going to put it in my sock drawer. And we thought, wouldn't it be great if we could all share those neat rocks with each other and maybe hopefully find out a little bit more about them? So we partnered up with the American Geophysical Institute, which is the big organization in the United States, and they provided us with a bunch of helpful explainers, 43 different geologists who teamed up with this to try and build our digital rock collection.
And how did that work out? Was it successful?
It was maybe a little too successful. We got over 1,000 rocks.
Whoa!
Representing all...
They sent you actual rocks?
Only a few. Most of them okay. were just pictures, like the ones you're seeing here. Pretty pictures of all kinds of super cool things that people sent to us. So all 50 states, 41 different countries. And so as you can imagine, it's taking a little bit of time for our 43 volunteer geologists to help classify and explain all 1,000 rocks. So if any of you people out there sent in a rock to us, we're going to get you. We're still working on it.
All right. Now that we're in Louisville, what about Kentucky? Did
so
we get any Kentucky
has a proud geologic history. And we had several rocks sent in that were very closely connected to this state. One is limestone. Limestone is largely part of why you have so many cool caves. Some people say that the limestone is also partially responsible for the water that gives all of your fine distilled beverages such a nice flavor.
Wow. And so are you still taking rocks? Are you still waiting for people to send pictures in?
We're going to be moving on to another project. I encourage all of you to become a member. You can find out more at sciencefriday.com/scienceclub.
Charles Berquist, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ira.
The director. Throughout the show, we have a special treat for you, some musical entertainment. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Bridge 19. Give them a big hand.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow coming to you from the Brown Theater in Louisville, Kentucky. And our theme tonight is, of course, on the rocks. And one of the things Kentucky is famous for is places where the rock isn't actually there anymore. I didn't know this. Did you know that Kentucky has 5,000 caves? 5,000 caves. I couldn't believe that. And well, we had to see one of these caves for ourselves. So our Science Friday producers headed down Interstate 65 to visit Crump's Cave in southern Kentucky to tour the underground lab of a couple of cave scientists. And they sent us back this audio postcard.
All right, so the first rule and first thing we should do is turn our lights on. This is Crump's Cave. We are going to go down and unlock the gate to the cave, and we'll walk down a small trail, about 50 feet or so, and we'll go to a waterfall. and in the waterfall, we have all of our research equipment set up. I am Jason Polk, and I am an associate professor of geosciences at Western Kentucky University, and I also direct the Center for Human Geoenvironmental Studies.
I am Fernando Hernandez, and I am a graduate student over here at Western Kentucky, and I'm studying springs in the Cumberland Plateau in Tennessee.
Just be careful of your footing in this first part because it's just loose rocks. So that sound you hear is water that is flowing out of a layer in the rock and falling as a waterfall and will flow until it reaches the actual water table for the region.
Look at this.
Whoa. What is that?
Just a cave cricket.
They're one of the main sources of energy inside the caves. So all the other critters that live inside, some of them never go out, but the crickets every night, they go outside of the cave, forage, come back, and other critters like salamanders or even pseudoscorpions or smaller things that live inside the cave eat either them or their poop or something out of them. So they're normally the backbone of the whole food cycle in the caves. So they're small and tiny, but they're really important inside here.
Looks like you got a bunch of leaky buckets over here.
We definitely do. This is our monitoring station. So we capture the water in the barrel to measure the level and flow, and then it flows into a smaller bucket where we have the sond with the probes. It's like taking a little snapshot. You know, we were able to pull a sample and capture it before it becomes part of the overall system. And from those water samples, we'll analyze them for things like E. coli. We'll look at all the different dissolved chemicals in the water. We can analyze for things like atrazine, which is a really commonly used herbicide here in Kentucky. And we're gonna walk down to the next waterfall that's in the cave. Everybody just watch your step. And about 25% of the world's population, so literally billions of people, depend on these types of systems for their drinking water. A lot of people don't really understand that all the things we study with pollution and contaminants and whatnot all does have bigger impacts too. This is the end of the portion of the cave that we own and what's really safe for us to keep doing without some additional training and gear. But anybody want a cricket for the road? If not, then we'll make our escape because it's cold in here.
Yeah, crickets. They do say that it is the food of the future. So that was Jason Polk and Fernando Hernandez of Western Kentucky University at Crump's Cave. And if you've ever had the chance to visit a cave, one of the things you might have seen is the incredible spectacle of huge swarms of bats, right, flying out of the cave at incredibly fast speeds. I mean, you're talking thousands of bats. But did you ever wonder how they do that without hitting each other, without running into each other? Or you say, oh, yeah, I've heard about that echolocation. Well, let me play you a sample of what echolocating bats leaving the bat cave sounds like. Sounds like a little sand, right? You really can't make any sense out of it. It's hard to understand, so I'm going to slow it down for you a little. I'm going to slow it down to make it 20 times slower. Still confused by that. How do they know where they're going and, you know, how do they know not to hit each other? The bats are somehow able to use these signals to communicate with themselves perfectly in their swarms. So we humans may have a lot to learn about how to communicate and how to echolocate from these bats. And my next guest says she wants to save the world by studying bats. How she's going to do that, I don't know, but we're going to ask her. Laura Klepper is an assistant professor of biology at St. Mary's College in Notre Dame, Indiana. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, you say you study the bats to save the world. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's my tagline that I give people. So as any good scientist, we have to be able to explain why we do what we do in terms of why this is, you know, the societal relevance or why, aside from just the pure interest in wanting to do science, what is the benefit for humanity? So I study biological sonar. I study not just bats, I also study dolphins. So both of those animals use biological sonar. And we've been studying these animals for almost a century now in order to do what we call biomimicry, which is to understand what the animals are doing to do something that benefits us. And for us, that would be sonar. So by studying these animals, we're learning how to make our own sonar devices.
Yeah, well, we use sonar and submarines and things like that, but it seems like the bats have really got it down differently. It's a much more complex thing that they're doing.
It is incredible. In fact, basically what they're doing, the reason why I study what the bats are doing is that all we know about science, physics, biology, says that they're doing an impossible task by echolocating in these large groups. What we know about how echolocation works is that when they're in these groups, the signals from each bat should be interfering with each other, and they should not be able to be using their sonar. They should be jamming their sonar and colliding and falling to the ground. But despite what we think is impossible, the bats are doing this, and they've been doing it this way for millions of years. So that just means we're missing part of the equation.
Must be missing a lot of that part.
We are missing quite a lot
of the equation. I understand that you've invented some unusual ways to study these bats from actually within the swarm. You get into the swarm.
Yeah, you know, I like to say that as a scientist, I have the coolest job on the planet because I get paid to develop and play with really cool toys, and then I get to take my toys to really fun locations, and then I get to tell everybody about the fun I'm doing in the field. So one of the questions that I'm ultimately wanting to get at is, what is it like to be a bat? And in order to really understand what it's like to be a bat, you need to get inside the swarm of those bats. You have to pretend like you're a bat. Now, I can't put on my Batman costume and fly into the swarm of the bats, so we invented a few unusual technologies in order to do this and get inside the swarm.
Such as
zip lines.
Zip lines.
Zip lines.
You get on a zip line?
No. I do
not
get on a zip line. We put our recorders on a zip line, and we fly our zip lines through the swarm of the bats so that we have our recording microphone matching the speed of the bats as it's going through the bat swarm. We also use drones.
Drones.
We fly drones. Yes.
Makes sense.
Yes. We put the drones up to get up off the ground. And then probably a favorite among the students in my lab is we have a hawk that we use to fly through the bats.
Hawk is not eating lunch going through the bats, is it?
No. Our hawk is not eating the bats. We've trained this hawk. Our hawk is named Belle after our school's mascot, the St. Mary's Bells. We have trained this hawk. It's been raised ever since it was a chick, so it's been hand-raised. And it knows it just flies from handler to handler, and it gets jackrabbit as its reward because we're in the fields of New Mexico. And this hawk carries a custom-built microphone and video unit and flies through the bats to get video and audio recording for us of the bats within the swarm.
Okay, so let's say I understand that you're trying to understand how good the bats are and how they do this. What kind of applications would you use the sonar that they do?
Right. So we use sonar in a lot of devices in everyday life. Sonar, for example, we use it to map the ocean floor. We use sonar for a form of sonar for self-driving vehicles underwater or for fish finders. Self-driving cars, they don't use sonar exactly. They use radar, but the same processing is the same idea. So one of the technological problems that we're working on is we have this rise in technology in our society is the need for automated transport, automated sensing is growing. And how you can have multiple vehicles in space using sonar is something that we haven't quite figured out, so we're looking to the bats for the solution.
You know, that really just hit home with me because we're talking about having thousands of cars on the road not hitting each other. The bats have figured out how to do that already. Tens of thousands of bats not bumping into each other. And that's what you want to know, how they do that.
That's what I hope to answer.
Well, tell us what it's like. So you follow these bats, or tens of thousands of bats, could be even more than that, right? What's a bat cave really like?
A bat cave is one of the coolest habitats on the planet. I'm a little biased, but... So let's see if I can take you into a bat cave.
Take me in.
Take you into a bat cave. So first of all, you can't just walk into a bat cave like this. We have to protect both the bats from us as well as us from the bats. So we wear sterile protective suits, waterproof Tyvek suits. Additionally, inside the bat cave, the caves I go to have about 500,000 bats or so.
Wait, 500,000 in the cave?
Oh, yeah.
One cave. Well, look how you're looking at me like that. Like that's really cool.
It's so cool. It's
So you wear these, you wear this special outfit.
So Tyvek suit. We also have to wear a full face respirator because there's so many bats inside the cave. They're urinating, they're defecating, so the ammonia levels are very high. So we have to protect our breathing. And there's also a toxic fungal spore inside the cave, histoplasmosis, which can cause all kinds of respiratory ailments. So we wear a lot of protective gear inside the cave. But that's not even the coolest part. So when you enter the cave.
You got me.
I know.
I'm waiting for the coolest part.
I wish I could take you there tonight, Ira. It's fantastic.
What time is
it? So when you start walking into the cave, you have all these bats inside a cave, and the bats are, you know, they're always defecating. So the guano starts to build up, and it builds up like a giant sand dune inside the cave. So when we enter the cave, we walk up the sand dune, and you kind of squish down, you squish into it. But not just that. There's all these insects in the cave that live off of the guano, as well as it's a maternal cave, so there's baby bats that are just born. And, you know, baby bats, there's a high mortality rate from the newborns. They fall from the cave ceiling. So the moment they land on the ground, there's a special type of beetle that starts eating the flesh of the baby bats alive. So the whole ground is moving and just seething with this movement.
So you're crawling up a mountain of guano. The floor is moving all around you. There are bats hanging from the ceiling.
No, they're flying around.
They're flying.
You've
even
disturbed
worse.
Them
they're
at
flying
this point.
Around.
So they're smacking into your head. Left
are they
and
smacking?
Right.
Are people afraid that bats get in your hair? Is that a myth? Or do they?
Well, we cover our heads.
Oh.
So.
But and how about if you have 100,000 bats or whatever in
500,000.
Excuse me. I don't mean to shortchange it. Now they have all that body heat. Do they heat the cave up?
They do. That cave gets very hot. In fact, when they're in the cave in tight clusters, the temperature inside the clusters of the bats can exceed the body temperature. We know this because we take special thermal cameras in there that can tell us the exact temperature measurement from within the cave. So because the bats they can create such high temperatures, that's part of the reason also why they're always moving around and milling about within the cave is to get rid of some of those temperatures. And just being in the cave too, it's very hot as a researcher because you're wearing a suit that doesn't breathe, so you get very sweaty.
How often do you do this?
I do this every summer for a month with my undergraduate students.
And look at you smiling about
it. It's fantastic.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Laura Klepper, Assistant Professor of Biology at St. Mary's College in Notre Dame, Indiana. I don't think there's a person who loves bats more than you do.
I don't know. There might be a few out there.
A few out there. Yeah. Now, I understand. See, a little birdie told me that you do a mean bat impression.
Oh, yeah.
Come on.
I do.
Give us. Don't you want to see her impression? Yeah.
Well, I have to give you a little bit of backstory beforehand. So first of all, when the bats are echolocating, they're not just keeping their heads straight. They're scanning their environment with their heads, as well as they can move their ears independently to perceive the echo. So when I do my bat impression, I go...
Wow. We've had a lot of demonstrations on Science Friday, but never such a unique bat impression.
You know, you spend a lot of time with bats, and you begin to learn them.
Go
a little
batty.
Bit. Yeah, well, perhaps.
Where did that expression come from? Does it have anything to do with bats? Can we go batty?
I believe it does. Yeah, I believe it has to do with some of the chemicals inside the bat cave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I love that, the little thing you did, the sound. Can you do it to the sound one
Again?
More time? I'm a sound guy. I love that.
Well, do you want to hear my slowed down bat call? Because that's in real time.
Absolutely. Slowed down bat call by Laura Klepper.
So backstory. I have to give backstory as a scientist. So the bats, these bats make what we call frequency modulated calls, which means they change in pitch over time. So although in real time we might hear, really what they're doing is they're going pew, pew, pew.
Wow. Oh, no. Two for the price of one. That's great. Can you teach that? Do you teach that to your students?
My students actually do a fantastic bat impression. It's part of the assignment in my lab.
On a Friday night when you're getting together after the lab is done, you're all doing the bat call together anytime?
It's kind of our signal to call each other at times in the hallway.
I know. I understand that you teach an all-women's undergraduate college.
I do.
And I understand that it's been a great opportunity for you to get many young women involved
in this
field.
Yeah. I have a really lively group of students. I've gotten Lots of students excited about bats, despite them never thinking they would be excited about bats. So we try to help spread the bat love and the bat joy around our campus.
Let's see if anybody in our audience. Yes, step up. Go ahead.
You mentioned how your work could save the world. Not too many years ago, on All Things Considered, there was an echolocation story about Daniel Kish, mm-hmm. how he could ride a bike, and can you comment on how a human could develop that?
Right, so there's a lot of people in my field that are trying to study human echolocation to understand exactly the mechanism with it, but when I work with school groups, I like to do a demo to show that we are all capable of a very rudimentary form of echolocation. You know, I have them have a person close their eyes, and it's this clicking mechanism, this. It makes what we call a broadband signal, which is a wide range of frequencies, and because it's a short duration, impulsive signal, it gives you really good information about your environment. And so I encourage you all to go home tonight and practice, and if you have someone put something up in front of your face with your eyes closed while you're clicking, you can actually detect the difference with your ear. And so it's thought that when people lose one of their senses, especially with vision, their hearing can become even more heightened, and so that's how they're able to use their echolocation.
Well, Dr. Klepper, this is incredibly fascinating. I want to thank you for taking time to be with
thank
us
you.
Today. Laura Klepper is an assistant professor of biology at St. Mary's College in Notre Dame, Indiana, and playing us to the break, Bridge 19. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, coming to you from the Brown Theater in Louisville, Kentucky. As you know, our theme tonight is On the Rocks, and I know what you're thinking in Louisville. That usually refers to the ice you put in your glass of bourbon. Yeah. But tonight, on Science Friday, it also means ice in space. And I'm talking about Uranus and Neptune, of course. They're called the ice giants of our solar system. And now that Cassini's mission to Saturn has been wrapped up, people are already thinking about where should we send the next orbiter. The ice giants of Uranus and Neptune are good candidates for this type of mission, not only because their distance from Earth makes them especially hard to study, but also because there's some interesting weather happening there that scientists would like to take a closer look at. For example, astronomers believe that inside the atmosphere of Neptune and Uranus, it's literally raining diamonds. Whoa, I want to go. I know it's hard to believe, so here with me to describe what we could learn from the wacky weather of these icy planets if we were to get a closer look at them is my guest, Tim Dowling, professor of planetary physics at the University of Louisville. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
So is diamond rain? How do we know it's raining diamonds on Uranus and Neptune?
Well, we don't, but that idea's been around for 30 years. It's basically the methane, which is very, very common, and it gets crushed into the pressure that makes diamonds. Now, this idea actually was confirmed this summer in Stanford. They had a couple of lasers hit polystyrene, which is just 8 C's and 8 H's, and that's very much like methane, and darned if all the carbon didn't turn into diamond.
Wow, in the laboratory. They tried it. So if you went there, you actually would see diamonds?
Well, you'd have to go about halfway in. So you'd have to have to think like Jules Verne's, right? So I think instead of the Nautilus, we'd have to call it Meshach and Shadrach or something because it's very hot. But to imagine a probe going down there is a challenge.
If we sent a probe, we might be able to confirm that.
Yes. Well, you know, the temperature is 5,000 degrees. It's the same temperature as the surface of the sun. So not only are you talking real bling here, it's bathed in a golden light, just like the sun. So it would be amazing to be able to see it.
Wow. And before Cassini, there was the Juno mission, which sent back data about Jupiter. And we learned something from that data about Jupiter and Neptune. They're similar, right?
Right. So the big surprise is Juno's an ongoing mission. It's our one and only big mission right now in the outer solar system. It gets very close. It has what's called proximity orbits. It gets almost in the peach fuzz. It's so close, and then it swings out every 53 days. Well, they're getting the gravity field from that, and from the from the details, they can actually figure out the interior structure. The math is very similar to an MRI at a doctor's office. So they can actually reconstruct the interior structure without ever going inside. It's the same idea, and it just takes a little longer. And so what they found to their surprise is that the core is not concentrated. It's very diffuse, in fact, almost out to halfway out. And then they started looking more closely at it, and it turns out you can think of Neptune and Uranus as being the core of Jupiter. That's the new paradigm.
Wow, so there's a sort of a rocky core with a gas bag surrounding it?
Maybe not so rocky. It's mostly this ice we're talking about. Now, we say ice, it's very hot, so it's melted. But it's methane, ammonia, and water. And that's what makes an ice giant. It was just after the Voyager encounters, which were 1986 for Uranus, 1989
right.
for Neptune. So in the early 90s, it was realized that these two planets, even though we call them gas giants, were fundamentally different. And what's different about them is their mantles, between the core and the outer atmosphere. It is not hydrogen and helium. In fact, it's water, methane, and ammonia. So that's the ice. That's where the name comes from.
So should we stop calling Jupiter then a gas giant?
Well, Jupiter is. So Jupiter has its mantle is actually hydrogen. And the funny thing about hydrogen, it sits over there on the left of the periodic table above lithium. It's in the lithium group. It's in the alkali metal group. But you don't think of it as a metal. But at those pressures, it becomes a metal. And so it's funny, but that's extremely exotic. But you think about it, most of the planetary mass in the solar system is metallic hydrogen. So that's what makes Jupiter and Saturn different. They're big enough for that to happen. And then the ice giants are the smaller class of planets.
You know, the one time we took a close look at Neptune was in 1989, when Voyager 2 passed by. I remember covering that as a journalist, and we got a view of something called the Great Dark Spot, right? Wow.
Yes, during the far encounter, as Voyager was coming closer and closer, all of a sudden the spot appeared. And so we said, oh my gosh, it's just like the Great Red Spot on Jupiter, except that it gallops. The other difference is it was drifting. It's a high-pressure system, and it was drifting towards the equator. You know, our hurricanes on Earth actually are low pressure, and they drift away from the equator,
right.
And for the same reason. So the physics is very similar. But this is anticyclone. It's a high pressure, and it drifts. And darned if the thing didn't die about 4 months after it was discovered. It was pure luck that we were there.
Is that right?
Yeah. We've had several appear since then, and all of them drift towards the equator, and they all basically kamikaze into the equator.
So what makes Neptune's Great Dark Spot different from Jupiter's Great Red Spot? We all know about that.
I have much better flow visualization on Jupiter. So I get almost all of my information from the incredible clouds that you can track on Jupiter. On Neptune, we have it by analogy, but you know, we couldn't even see the temperature anomaly for the Great Dark Spot. So it was a real frustrating because the flyby happened so quickly. And basically, we were in discovery mode. The neat thing about the way NASA does its lap around the solar system is the first time it's guaranteed to always get great science, right? You put a camera in a new place and you always get great science. But that's the discovery mode, and we've pretty much lapped the solar system. So now the next step is the hypothesis mode that most, like NSF, has to do all their science that way.
Yeah.
You have to have a hypothesis. And so that's the mode we're in now. That's why you follow up with these orbiters.
So, you know, we're looking now at a picture of Neptune from Voyager, I think, probably.
They knew this was going to happen. You see, every feature on Neptune is on the same shot. Well, there's an enormous shear. The biggest shear in the solar system between these different. And so they actually predicted that. The thing about these planets is you can predict the weather with a ruler and a stopwatch. And so this was known weeks before it was going to happen, that they were going to get this family portrait. And so that becomes the poster child for the whole mission.
If you have a question you'd like to ask, we have the microphone set up on the aisles here. And also there's a microphone in the balcony. It's so gorgeous. Blue.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the blue and there's the dark, little dark spot there. Where's the blue come from? There are no oceans like we have.
Right. It's not blue for the same reason. But don't you agree with me that a blue planet with white clouds is a very comforting.
Yeah.
Especially to have traveled that far out and to see those. It's because the methane gas is absorbing the red light. So it's not the same. We have what's called Rayleigh scattering. So when we look up. But, you know, when you look down on the Earth, you're not seeing blue because of the atmosphere. We don't really have a lot of methane. You see it because of the ocean.
Right.
But when you look up from inside, you see the blue. And here it's all basically the methane gas.
We have a question from the audience. Let's go right to this side. Yeah, step up to the mic.
Hi, Dr. Dowling. Thank you. I know you'd like to see more missions, orbiters, as you said, to some ice giants, to Neptune or Uranus. Two questions in regards to that. The easy one first. Do you think the hypothesized Planet 9 also would count as an ice giant? Is it what's likely there? And the harder one, what of the current political environment, both the whole administration, does their and antipathy for aliens extend to potential NASA discoveries? Or does and our local reps, Kentucky and Indiana, would they be likely to support?
The NASA budget is actually doing pretty well with this current administration, so I won't go too much more into that. We only have the two ice giants here. Most of the other planets or minor or dwarf planets are going to be ice, actually literally rock ice. It's interesting, though, you know, we have over 3,500 confirmed exoplanets, planets out of other solar systems. That's a large number, and they're starting to get good statistics. And it turns out 85%, to our great surprise, are planet types that we do not have in the solar system. So there's a gap between the size of Venus and Earth. There's a gap between that size and the ice giant size. And so they're called mini-Neptunes and super-Earths. Those are actually two planet classes. There's a gap between them. And so why does our solar system not have the most common planet type? We're trying to put our solar system in context, and we find out that it's unusual.
Why does a weather person care about what's going on in those planets? I mean, how would that affect what we know about us?
It turns out that the weather on these planets is easier to predict and easier to understand. It's cleaner. I think back to the Nobel Prize in Medicine in 2000. It was the California sea hare. Did you cover that? Do you remember that? It was the big, thick neuron, and they could do the pulse and get the timing with a sea slug. And it was to learn about humans and to make progress with physiology, but you don't do it with humans. It's the same thing here. So we very much need to learn about Earth, but Earth doesn't come with a user manual, so we have to write our own, right? So you want to go to the other planets for that, and Jupiter is our sea slug.
Let's go to the audience. Yes, sir, here on this side. Step up to the mic, please.
Yeah, hey, Ira, I love what you do, man. I have one quick question. The James Webb Space Telescope, I know you'd love to send orbiters to these planets, but is it feasible to do a great amount of science with that possible mission? Thank you.
Yes, the James Webb Space Telescope is the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope, and it's just about to go up. It's already, and it's very exciting. So we have good news is that the planetary community is getting a fair bit of time for James Webb. It's very heavily subscribed, of course, by all the different galactic and extragalactic astronomy. But it's going to have some new wavelengths, and we're going to be able to see deeper and more often. And it's turning out that even the ground-based telescopes with what's called adaptive optics, where they can actually warp the telescope and actually account for the turbulence in the atmosphere, is giving us some incredibly crystal clear images. But it's really tantalizing because there's nothing like being there.
Yeah. So let's say this audience is your board at NASA or someplace, and you want to talk this audience into sending a probe to one of these planets. Give me your pitch, your elevator pitch for where you'd like to go and what kind of probe we should be sending.
Well, we've discovered that 85% of the planets in the universe are mini Neptunes, and we have a Neptune and a Uranus waiting for us. And the whole story of the formation of the solar system is how Jupiter moved around and how Uranus and Neptune moved around. And we need to go there with a probe to get the noble gases. That's the only way you can do it. You can't do it remotely. You have to send a probe in situ to get the noble gases. And you can't change the noble gases with regular chemistry. That's the point. So they tell you like a fingerprint. They tell you the history of the formation of the solar system. That's where we came from.
Okay. Where I'm going to is this young lady here on the mic. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering if the diamonds on different planets are the same in like shape or like how much pressure is needed to be made than on Earth?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
Great
question.
So obviously Earth is making diamonds. We have diamond envy in this country. We have 50 states, and there's only one state where you can find diamonds. It's Arkansas. It's actually next door to Kentucky here.
What does that mean, do you think?
I don't know. The diamond itself is going to be the same everywhere it's formed. You know, if you put a little aluminum in these atmospheres, you can get rubies and sapphires as well. But the pressure...
Is Elon Musk listening to this as you talk about that?
The pressure is 1.5 megabars. That means there's one bar in this room. You know, we're in the middle of the country, but we're at 300 feet above sea level here because we're right 7 blocks from the Ohio River. So exactly the pressure that you're breathing right now, multiply that by 1.5 million, that's the pressure. The temperature is about between 5,000 and 6,000 degrees, which is the same as the temperature of the surface of the sun.
And you thought it was bad outside tonight. Let me go right here, yes, sir.
How much would it cost to bring an orbiter to a nice planet, and how long would it take?
Yeah. It takes about 10 years. It's a big commitment just to get there, and then you would want the orbiter to last about that long again. But Cassini was a wonderful model for that. It lasted 13 years. It costs somewhere above $1 billion. So NASA has these, yes, NASA has these different levels of mission. And so there's a mission called the New Horizons or New Frontiers mission, which is capped at $1 billion. The one above that is called a flagship. And so I think what Cassini has taught us, those cost about $3 or $4 billion. It's very expensive. It was so expensive that NASA actually almost canceled the Cassini mission because they thought there was too much. But I think what Cassini showed us is that if you do put the kitchen sink in and you go all in, that you have incredible flexibility and you have a 13-year mission that was originally a 5-year mission. And it was just fantastic. They did everything with Cassini. That's what we need to send to Uranus or Neptune.
This is Science Friday from PRI. Let's talk about the atmosphere of Uranus. We study these Uranus and these planets also, and I think we have a slide of this from ground-based telescopes, right?
Right.
What have we been able to learn about the weather on Uranus? Is it very similar to the weather on Neptune?
This is just incredible. I want you to remember that Uranus is the size of a quarter at a mile's distance in the sky, and this is done with a ground-based under the atmosphere telescope at Keck, and this is that adaptive optics, and that's beating swords into plowshares. That's a military application that was turned into an astronomical technique. This surface weather is what the model that we've been developing here in Louisville for 20 years, the EPIC model, this is what we do. So this data is just really exciting. And all the white clouds are actually methane ice.
Wow. So you get excited by
stuff. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Don't you?
What would make your day about? Tell me the best thing that, really, that you could discover that would say,
I think what gives me the greatest kick for doing this is bringing results back to Earth. And so it was, especially Jupiter, but all four of these gas giants, they are so clean. You know, the weather is going east and west. There's just not a lot of turbulence. The prediction horizon is in the months here, not weeks. You know, for Earth, it's 2 weeks, and it's always going to be that. So we can learn more by studying this, but I'm basically saying I love being a veterinary scientist and love how it helps us learn about the human body. It's the same thing. I love being a planetary scientist to learn about the most important planet of all.
I see that you hate your job, Tim. Thank you. Tim Dowling, Professor of Planetary Physics, University of Louisville. Thank you very much. That's about all the time we have for this evening. Wow, but we have a lot of people we want to thank. We want to give our heartfelt thanks to John Grants, Michael Scholar, Kirsten Falzgraf, Aaron Palmer, and all the wonderful folks at Louisville Public Media. Thank you all for... Also, we want to thank everybody here at the Brown Theater for making this such a wonderful evening to everybody. We also want to thank the National Speleological Society. Yes, the largest organization on Earth dedicated to the exploration, study, and conservation of caves. Visit them on www.caves.org. And most of all, we want to thank all of you for coming out tonight. You've been a great crowd. Thank you for coming out in the weather. Also, let's give one last round of applause to our amazing musical guests, Bridge 19. Thank you all for coming. Drive home safely, everybody. In Louisville, Kentucky, I'm Ira Flatow.